The nuclear industry counts on we the people to be easily confused by their double talk, and they love to play the game of the right hand doesn't know what the left hand is doing. Case in point, recent meetings on the decommissioning of the Pilgrim nuclear reactor in Plymouth, Massachusetts, and what's going to happen to the highly radioactive so-called spent fuel rods, which are filled with radioactive plutonium. While the decommissioning company, Holtec, is under intense political and public pressure to not build a consolidated so-called interim storage facility, or CIS, in New Mexico as a dump for highly radioactive waste, up in Boston, at a public presentation, they're implying, if not stating outright, that it's a done deal, and will be taking the dangerous waste away from the urban Boston area. By misleading the public in many ways, including...
And on one of the slides, it said that Holtec was planning to open a CIS in New Mexico and should be taking waste shortly after in 2024. So they're setting up the people to believe that, and that's what everyone wants to believe, it's going to be out of here. That's not happening. And so people aren't really hyper-focused on what's really happening with the waste in Plymouth.
Well, when you hear a genuine expert and eyewitness to these events catch out a major nuclear industry player in such a blatant, let's not call it a lie, let's just call it a misdirection for now, it once again points out how insidiously we are all being manipulated to remain sitting in that terrible seat that we all share.
Nuclear hot seat, what are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat, what have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat, the corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are linking. Nuclear hot seat, it's the bomb.
Welcome to Nuclear Hot Seat, the weekly international news magazine keeping you up to date on all things nuclear from a different perspective. My name is Libby Halevi. I'm the producer and host, as well as a survivor of the nuclear accident at Three Mile Island from just 1 mile away. So I know what can happen when those nuclear so-called experts get it wrong. This week, we catch up on the problems with the now shut down but still dangerous Pilgrim Nuclear Power Facility in Plymouth, Massachusetts. We talk with Diane Turco, director of the Cape, as in Cape Cod, Cape Downwinders, about the current decommissioning situation, lack of security on site for the dangerously radioactive spent fuel pools, and how her quest to keep the public informed was used to bring her up on charges as she faces a jury trial this fall. We will also have nuclear news from around the world, numbnuts of the week for outstanding nuclear boneheadedness, and more honest nuclear information than even Dr. Fauci is allowed to share with us. All of it coming up in just a few moments. Today is Tuesday, July 7, 2020, and here is this week's nuclear news from a different perspective. You know, I was providing a weekly COVID nuclear report, and one of my listeners wrote to me and said, "What happened? Where is it?" Well, the problem is that there has been almost no news anywhere about COVID as it relates to the nuclear industry, at least in the last several weeks. Now, one might think that the nuclear industry and the governments that support it have, like the Nuclear Regulatory Commission here in the U.S., removed all mention of COVID-19 positives on site and any problems that might exist because of refueling or social distancing difficulties at nuclear reactors from public visibility. I mean, they have stated that they won't post anything. This is just like what happened after Fukushima. When reports were that a radiation plume was headed to the west coast of North America, quote, in 8 days after the triple meltdown began in March 2011. The next day, there was talk of it hitting the west coast in 7 days, then 6 days, and on the fifth day, The story disappeared. You couldn't even find the word plume anywhere in mainstream media talking about what was happening at or from Fukushima. Standard operating procedure. Be that as it may, we do have one story dealing with the COVID nuclear connection. Beyond Nuclear sent out a press release in which they decried the suppression of state assessments that could reveal plans to drastically raise the threshold of radiation exposure before evacuating the public from a nuclear emergency under COVID-19 conditions. The group pointed to a document from the state of Connecticut, which was posted and then removed by the NRC without explanation, indicating the state, Connecticut, would wait to evacuate some people until radiation levels reached a staggering 100 rem, the point at which radiation sickness can begin. Beyond Nuclear has demanded that NRC and FEMA make public the response from every state to FEMA's assessment of the viability of off-site radiological emergency plans for those nuclear power stations that are still operating during the COVID-19 pandemic. Connecticut stated that the social distancing requirements of the COVID-19 pandemic posed, quote, a significant impediment to an orderly evacuation. It looks like they're not for shelter in place, they're for fry in place from the radioactivity. The U.S. House Appropriations Committee reported out of legislation regarding fiscal year 2021 spending for the Energy Department. Bob Alvarez did a quick breakdown on it and points out that it includes $13.7 billion for nuclear weapons programs, which is less than Trump asked for, which was $15.6 billion, but still $13.7. $7.46 billion, which is an increase above Trump's request, for nuclear weapons site cleanup. $31 million, $2.2 million above the request, for the Defense Nuclear Facility Safety Board. $1.25 billion for a small modular reactor design and construction and for the Department of Energy's nuclear R&D program. We'll hear more about this during NumNuts. Two indications of the thinking behind our radioactive waste disposal problem. The fiction of Yucca Mountain as a high-level permanent radioactive waste disposal site was revealed as barely being on life support funding, and the site remains unplugged. There are also no funds for the proposed consolidated interim storage sites in New Mexico and West Texas for commercial power reactor spent fuel. And you'll learn more about this Holtec right-hand, left-hand, underhanded misrepresentation of these so-called interim storage sites during today's interview. Further analysis and pushback against the Department of Energy's budget came from Senator Maria Cantwell, a Democrat from Washington State, in a speech on the Senate floor. She said that this budget would remove checks and balances on the nation's nuclear weapons program, wrestling away civilian control of the nation's nuclear arsenal and giving it solely to the military. The language in the bill would also allow the Department of Defense to, quote, raid dollars used by the Department of Energy for cleanup of nuclear waste and for energy research, making the money available to be spent on the nation's nuclear arsenal. Because let's face it, making nuclear weapons and the threat of nuclear war is so much more fun than what it takes to clean up the mess you made, the radioactive mess you made, in the process of making those weapons. But hey, here comes word from the U.S. Air Force's top general, Chief of Staff General David Goldfein, who said that the current budget does not allow for the purchase of both nuclear and conventional weapons simultaneously, and you've got to pick one. The Congressional Budget Office has estimated that the Pentagon's nuclear weapons spending plan would cost $494 billion between 2019, 2020 now, and 2028, an average of about $50 billion with a B per year. Imagine the amount of PPE and subsidies for people going through COVID emergencies and schools and health and infrastructure and all the other things we the people need to support life that could be purchased for $50 billion per year. Our tax dollars at, I can't say work, squander. Three U.S. senators have now introduced legislation to require congressional approval for any nuclear testing in Nevada. U.S. Senators from Nevada, Catherine Cortez Masto and Jackie Rosen, plus Chris Coons of Delaware, have introduced legislation to ensure no president can unilaterally decide to resume explosive nuclear testing by establishing a congressional approval process for any future nuclear testing in Nevada and across the country. The No Nuclear Testing Without Approval Act will ensure that Congress is involved should there be an effort by any administration to resume explosive nuclear testing. Now, let's have another bill to take that unilateral ability to launch a real nuclear weapon at a real other country out of the sole and uncontradictable hands of whoever happens to be president. At the Los Alamos National Laboratory, 15 workers are being evaluated for exposure to plutonium-238 following an accident on June 8 with a glove box glove breach. If you saw the movie Silkwood, you'd be very familiar with what those glove boxes look like. On June 8, an operator pulled out of the glove box gloves after weighing and packaging plutonium-238 oxide powder. He received significant, the nuclear industry's favorite word, significant contamination on his protective clothing, hair, and skin, as well as positive nasal swabs indicating a potential intake. In other words, the guy's got internal contamination from the plutonium. The room experienced significant, that word again, airborne radioactivity and was contaminated. As a result, 14 additional workers have been placed on bioassay. On July 1st, the offline Fermi nuclear power plant in Michigan lost power because of an invasion of mayflies. Emergency backup diesel generators were forced to kick in. Thus, mayflies join with jellyfish and salp, a kind of sea bream, in their ability to shut down the operation of nuclear reactors. If bugs and jellyfish can shut down nuclear reactors, so can we. And now,
Nuclear Hot Seat, Nuclear Hot Seat, Nuclear Hot Seat, none that's out a week.
The nuclear industry, always on the lookout for the next way they can scam big bucks out of the government by some incredible promise, says that they have come up with a new fuel, which they call nuclear powerballs, and that they may make meltdowns a thing of the past. These theoretical new nukes, none of which has been designed, let alone built, will be fueled by what is being called TRISO fuel, T-R-I-S-O, which consists of millions of submillimeter-sized grains of uranium individually wrapped in protective shells. Industry press releases refer to it as a radioactive gobstopper, whatever that's supposed to mean. Each particle of fuel has three alternating layers of graphite and a ceramic called silicon carbide, and each particle is smaller than a poppy seed. Promoters claim that a combination of new reactor designs plus this new fuel, you will have essentially created an accident-proof reactor. Which brings to mind what they used to say about the Titanic before it was built. And it doesn't help their case that the name of this miraculous new fuel comes from the Spanish trisar, which means to crack or chip. Going to have to do a cost-benefit analysis on rebranding that name. And all this is why anyone who is touting these buckyballs of TRISO as the way to create nuclear safety in the future, you are this week's
Nuclear Hot Seat, none that's out a week.
Over to Japan, where Okinawa Governor Denny Tamaki has rejected the U.S. plans to base on the island missiles capable of threatening China. Governor Tanaki said that if a plan for Okinawa to host such missiles were to develop, quote, I can easily imagine fierce opposition from Okinawa residents. Missiles the U.S. plans to base on Okinawa are prohibited by the 1987 Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces, or INF, treaty between the United States and the Soviet Union. But as president, Donald Trump formally withdrew from the treaty on August 2nd of 2019. China has said that if the U.S. insists on the deployment of these missiles, it will be a provocation at China's doorstep, and China will take all necessary countermeasures. In Iran, fire at the Natanz nuclear facility has caused significant, that word again, damage. Natanz is the Islamic Republic's main uranium enrichment center, located 250 kilometers or 155 miles south of Tehran, and is one of several Iranian facilities monitored by inspectors of the International Atomic Energy Agency. And in Turkey, the new Sinop nuclear plant seeks an environmental impact assessment without a reference reactor. There is also not a valid agreement to build it, nor a company to be commissioned for the construction of the reactors. We're going to link to this article, which is by Pinar Demirkan, who is one of Nuclear Hot Seat's longtime listeners and a correspondent. We'll have this week's featured interview in just a moment, but first, nuclear weapons on hair trigger alert, the framework of international nuclear treaties demolished, the seeming inevitability of a new arms race, Space Force aiming to introduce nukes into space, and the official rah-rah pro-nuclear propaganda push linked to the 75th anniversary of the atom bombs being dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. The nuclear industry just loves its talking points as it keeps pushing onward, relentlessly intent upon gobbling up money for the few and polluting human resources for everyone else, yes, you included. We are facing a wider range of nuclear dangers than ever before, and the only way to fight against them is to know what's going on and what you can do to change things. That is why you need Nuclear Hot Seat. We look at the nuclear aspect of our world every week, and especially now, with coronavirus wreaking havoc on safety of reactors, weapons, and radioactive waste. You won't get this information from mainstream media. Nuclear Hot Seat is the only place you can count on to report on the ongoing, evolving nuclear truth about weapons, waste, uranium mining, and the COVID nuclear connection. To keep this show running takes time, energy, effort, and funding. But COVID has hit us as hard as anyone, which makes your help at this time necessary to keep the show going. That's why the time would be right now to support us with a donation. We make it easy. Just go to nuclearhotseat.com, click on the big red donate button for a donation of any size, and to send us a monthly $5, the same as a cup of coffee and a nice tip here in the U.S., click on the big green donate button. Please do what you can now, and know that however much you can help, I'm deeply grateful that you're listening and that you care. Now, here's this week's featured interview. Just because a nuclear reactor gets shut down does not mean that it is now safe and activists can go home and get back to their lives without any further concern. If anything, the battle over the accumulated decades of highly radioactive nuclear waste and what to do with it can be and is proving to be even more complex, dangerous, and frightening than the fight it took to shut down the reactors in the first place. Nowhere is this more clear than at the shuttered Pilgrim Nuclear Power Reactor in Plymouth, Massachusetts. Yes, it is no longer in operation, but the problems continue, as today's guest will make clear. On last week's show, number 471, we caught what seemed to be a manipulation, some might call it a lie, in the way Holtec framed what it was going to be able to do with the highly radioactive waste from Pilgrim. Now, you'll hear the whole truth of the matter. Diane Turco is director of the CAPE, as in Cape Cod, Cape Downwinders. She's a four-decade veteran of the battle to close the reactor down, and as you will hear, she is deeply involved in the fight for total, transparent safety during the decommissioning process by a company with a non-existent track record for decommissioning nukes, along with a well-established track record for legal malfeasance. Diane Turco and I spoke on Monday, July 6, 2020.
Diane Turco, it's always a pleasure and an eye-opener to have you on Nuclear Hot Seat, so welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Pilgrim Nuclear in Massachusetts was shut down on May 31st, 2019, and is now facing what every nuclear reactor and community faces, decommissioning the facility, and then what do we do with the deadly radioactive waste that's left behind? Let's start with a little bit of history of the site. What were the problems there? And give us a picture of what happened at Pilgrim leading up to the shutdown.
Pilgrim was rated by the Nuclear Regulatory Commission for 4 years as the worst reactor in the United States. And as the NRC completed their special inspections and found more and more problems, systemic mismanagement, not fixing equipment, not filing reports, but the more oversight that the NRC provided, the worse Pilgrim became. And it's just systemic mismanagement, and we're seeing that transferring over to Holtec right now. And we're very concerned about now the decommissioning. I thought when they shut down Pilgrim, I could retire and play with my grandkids.
What has been happening at Pilgrim since the shutdown? It's a little over a year now.
Holtec is a major problem, and the lack of the nuclear regulatory oversight, as we know, is historical. So Holtec came into town and professed that they would be open and transparent with the community about what they would be doing during decommissioning and how they would be handling the waste, when in fact they were not. And so we're seeing a corporation that has a reputation for corruption, bribery, and scandal, and they're now patting themselves on the back for the settlement with the Attorney General's office in the state of Massachusetts.
What were the issues involved between the state and Holtec that led to them having to negotiate their way into a settlement? And what and how good or bad is that settlement?
The Attorney General in the state of Massachusetts determined that Holtec really didn't have the funding available to do a safe and complete decommissioning of Pilgrim. And they felt that there were financial, environmental, and public safety concerns that weren't being addressed. So the Attorney General's office filed a petition to intervene in February of 2019 to make sure that we were protected here in the state of Massachusetts. Well, it took over a year for this to be resolved. The NRC staff approved the license transfer, and that happened. And they hadn't even addressed the Attorney General's concerns. And so Holtec has just been moving forward on their own without considering what the needs were of the community and the state.
Is it typical that the NRC, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, our national regulators, would ignore the concerns of the Attorney General of a state that is dealing with a nuclear reactor that has to go through decommissioning?
Well, the NRC's regulations don't protect us, and our state is trying to, so the NRC is feeling that they're, you know, what they're doing is the right thing, and it's not happening. Luckily, our state did get some good concessions in this agreement, but dealing with Holtec, we know that, you know, again, a corporation that's known for bribery, corruption, and scandal, can we trust that this is really going to be upheld? So when the Holtec came to Plymouth, their vice president, Joy Russell, stated that Holtec had an impeccable safety record. And we had to turn around to her and say, well, how many reactors have you decommissioned? Zero. And second, we said, and you know what? Have you been following what's happening at San Onofre? So we already know that we can't trust this corporation to do the right thing by our communities.
What was their response to the San Onofre query?
A dirty look to me.
No answer.
That was it. No answer. No.
Now, Holtec, and I find this to be laughable, Holtec has said that they can handle the entire decommissioning job in about 8 years. How realistic is that, and how confident or not confident are you that they can do the job properly, let alone in that time frame?
I have no confidence in Holtec upholding what they say. Holtec had a slide presentation at the Nuclear Decommissioning Citizens Advisory Panel in Plymouth. It's a public event. It's broadcast. And on one of the slides, it said that Holtec was planning to open a CIS in New Mexico and should be taking waste shortly after in 2024.
And CIS is Consolidated Interim Storage Site, which
yes.
is a whole other subject we've been covering on Nuclear Hot Seat right. as well. I caught that reference, and I was wondering whether they were trying to say, oh, it's a done deal, and we'll just ship the waste when there's no approval, there's no site, there's no legality behind it.
Exactly. So they're setting up the people to believe that, and that's what everyone wants to believe, it's going to be out of here. That's not happening. And so people aren't really hyper-focused on what's really happening with the waste in Plymouth. Now, Plymouth is America's hometown. They were going to be celebrating their 400th anniversary this year and having millions of visitors come to Plymouth. And this waste site, this waste dump, is not protected. You know, I have gone on the property with multiple reporters where we've been on the property for 30 minutes, eyeballing the dry casks, waving to the security cameras, and no one comes out.
So safety is a word that should be put in quotes when it comes to Holtec's dealing with Pilgrim.
Yes, yes.
You mentioned the Massachusetts Attorney General, Maura Healey. She's the one who first called Holtec's plan for decommissioning, quote, a wholly misguided premise that asked local and federal officials to trust that the plant's decommissioning trust fund had enough money for Holtec, quote, on its first attempt to decommission and restore the site at a pace never before achieved. Now, she has said that the agreement, which was come to only this past June, provides environmental, public safety, and financial protections during the dismantling and cleanup of the plant. What changed, or did anything change?
That's a really good question, because we do see that they did get some concessions from Holtec. But the bottom line is, and I'll go through those concessions in a minute, but the bottom line is this agreement is signed by two LLCs, Holtec Decommissioning International and Holtec Pilgrim. Legal entities responsible for this agreement. What happens if they go bankrupt?
So it's a legal entity that's responsible for the cleanup, but there's no legal mandate for the company to come behind it. Is that what you're saying?
That's what we're questioning. You know, they did look for financial assurance, and they're asking for $193 million to be kept in the decommissioning trust fund.
That's what the state is asking.
Yes, yes, that's in the plan. Yes, this is in the agreement. Because if you look at what Holtec has for assets, it's just the property. And that's it. Their parent company, as you know, is Holtec SLC Lavalin, but they're a parent company. They're not part of the LLC. So we're concerned that they could become bankrupt. The Attorney General has suggested that when Holtec files to get the money back from the spent fuel storage fund reimbursements, they will use that DOE money to put back into the decommissioning trust fund to keep it at that level.
Sounds like a shell game.
Oh, yes, it does. It does. It does. And someone even asked, I think they asked the AG's office, what would happen if they don't put that money into the DOE fund? The Attorney General's office said, well, we'll have to chase them down. I just love Maura Healey, our Attorney General, and that whole team. They're a great group of people. But when I look back at who they're dealing with, it's very disconcerting.
You said you were going to go through the terms of some of the concessions that mm-hmm. were gotten from Holtec or this Holtec right. LLC.
Right.
What are they?
There are three kind of points that I'll bring up because it is a pretty long document. But you know, all of these issues should have been resolved without having to have this long settlement agreement that took over a year to be signed. One is the financial assurance and keeping those funds, $193 million in the decommissioning trust fund for contingency plans, the partial site release, and then $38 million after the partial site release for the spent fuel. They're getting detailed reporting. Now, the Nuclear Decommissioning Citizens Advisory Panel has been asking for, give us updates, let us know what you're doing, what is going on here, and they just did not cooperate in the most minimal way with the citizens group. So now they have to provide monthly reports. And then for site restoration, the Department of Environmental Protection and the Department of Public Health has asked for historical site assessments. They wanted ongoing monitoring of radiation, and they wanted a site assessment, and that's all going to happen. They're also hiring a site licensed person to oversee this. The person will be paid for by Holtec, but they're licensed by the state, and they're supposed to help with the reports to DEP and DPH. There will be an initial Pilgrim environmental site assessment that will be overseen by this licensed professional who's licensed by the state of Massachusetts, but works for Holtec and is paid for by Holtec. But that person will be providing reports to the Department of Public Health and the Department of Environmental Protection, which they should be doing anyways. That's just kind of communicating with the state on this huge disaster in our backyard.
And what is the potential of this person who, while maybe hired by the state, is working for Holtec and in that Holtec environment, of being in some way compromised or impacted or influenced in the accuracy of his or her reports?
This is the same person who's being hired, who was part of the Yankee Row decommissioning, and another person who was involved with that said he wasn't that good. So with the citizens, it's still going to have to be on top of this. We're just going to have to be reading all these reports and making sure that they're complete.
One of the points that I found particularly disturbing is that Holtec seems to believe that once they are done with decommissioning, or what they are calling decontamination, which I don't know is possible, they're talking about possible reuse of the site. What in the world could they possibly mean by that?
It sounds like just a sales pitch to me. Who is ever going to build on that site? And when the NRC came to Plymouth and talked about reusing the property, they actually said they would build a elementary school next to the ISFSI.
Meaning next to the site of Pilgrim.
Right, where Pilgrim is now, they would allow elementary school to be built there. It was at the November meeting, I think. I asked them and I said, could you repeat, did you just say, you would say it's okay once the site is released that elementary school could be built right next to the ISFSI? And they mentioned Rancho Seco. And they said, well, that's still all there, but we would recommend an elementary school be built there on that site.
I've also seen that there are certain things that Holtec has said that they're going to do for the local community of Plymouth to assist them. What are these steps?
In true NRC fashion, and Holtec follows that line, they will be putting trees around the IS, the Independent Spent Fuel Facility, to hide it. Instead of protecting us, they want to hide it as if nobody would know it was there. You know, bad actors know that site is so open, and we feel that we're much at risk to acts of malfeasance because there is no protection there. But trees, if you go down the driveway of Pilgrim, there's under the no trespassing signs, there's another sign that says danger, poison ivy. It's true. I'll send it to you. It's true.
Please send me that picture.
Are you kidding me? Danger, poison ivy, right under the trespassing signs.
Well, of course, that's the worst thing one can get from a nuclear radioactive site.
So maybe they're planning to plant poison ivy all over the property.
That would probably be more effective than what their current security levels are.
Right.
And let me ask you about that. What security is Holtec going to be providing during this decommissioning process?
Right. We asked Holtec and the NRC, what is the security? But it's kind of, what is that word? They can't release it because it's proprietary. But what the agreement did, and you'll be shocked at this, or maybe not, what the agreement did was look at cybersecurity, which there is none. And they did get in the agreement that they will improve their cybersecurity, and get this, they will use secure remote access methods, like they don't have that now. They will use only strong passwords. change default passwords and consider other access controls. I mean, this is common sense security, and they don't even have it now. It's part of this agreement because the NRC doesn't require it.
This is outrageous. And when they talk about cybersecurity, excuse me, I don't know what cybersecurity is going to do when you've got a physical facility there with spent fuel rods, which are highly radioactive, all the radioactive material that is from the containment vessel, and all of the contamination that has leaked out during the decades of its operation.
Right.
So I know that you have been protesting against Pilgrim for how many decades is it now?
Since the early 1980s, when I went to a lecture by Dr. Helen Caldicott, and she just changed my life.
She has a habit of doing that. Mine too.
Yes.
More recently, there has been a lawsuit filed against you, or there are charges against you that are calling you in for, actually, is this going to be a hearing or a trial or what? Explain the circumstances under which these charges were filed and what it has led to thus far.
In November of 2018, two National Public Radio reporters called me and asked if I could take them to Pilgrim to see the site, as I had been writing about how this was security. I had gone on the site previously in August with Walter Robinson of Spotlight fame. And so I wrote about being on the property with Walter Robinson, standing there, and no security came out for about a half an hour. So we went on to the site in November, and we stood around waving to the security cameras. No security came out. So about 20 minutes later, we got in our cars and drove to the main entrance on the other side of the property and went into the building to find the security. And they finally came out after we were like calling them, and we were told to leave, and we said, okay. I said, let's take our time because I want to see if they're going to look out the window to make sure we really go down the driveway. And they finally did come out, looked at us. We waved and left. And 3 hours later, there was a knock on my door, and there was a Harwich police officer. Now, I live 50 miles from Pilgrim, about an hour away. And a Harwich police officer knocked on my door and asked me if I had been at Pilgrim that day. And I said, yes. And he said, well, you shouldn't go there. You could be arrested for trespassing. I just started laughing. I'm like, are you kidding me? You're in my home telling me not to go to Pilgrim when I was eyeballing those dry casks hours ago? So a few weeks later, I received a call from the Plymouth police, again, asking me if I was on the property. Yes, well, you would be charged with trespassing. You will have to go to a magistrate's hearing. So I actually was never arrested for trespassing. I had to go to a magistrate's hearing and say, yes, I was on the property at this date, at this time. And then I was charged with trespassing. Can you imagine if I was a bad actor? And that's what we were trying to show is, you know, this isn't the first time. In 2014 with Cheryl Fiendaker, an investigative reporter filmed us on the property while armed guards are walking by us, going off the property, looking for people who are in the area. Yeah. And then with Walter Robinson later on. So we were trying to expose the fact that there's no security here. I mean, if the NRC requires cameras, the cameras may be there, but they're not being monitored, and I don't even know if they're working. But the police report said that I said that we went in an area that nobody could see us, and I never said that. So anyways, fast forward, the pretrial hearing was in September, but the district attorney wasn't prepared, so they moved that up 2 months. Another pretrial hearing, the district attorney wasn't prepared again, they moved it up again. Well, when they moved it up, they set a date which some of my witnesses couldn't make. Walter Robinson, he teaches at the University of Arizona. Michael Dukakis, former Governor Michael Dukakis, is at UCLA.
These are the people who are going to bear witness on your behalf.
Yes, yes, yes. And so we asked that the trial be moved to the spring when they come back from their teaching positions out west. But then COVID happened. And so it was postponed to July, and now it's been postponed again till September.
So there's no way to do this virtually over Zoom. You can't see a magistrate or be on trial if...
Well, it's actually a trial, yes.
With a jury and a jury box and everything.
Yes. Full jury trial. And Dave Lockbaum will be another witness too. Former Union Concerned Scientist David Lockbaum will be a witness. And he wrote a really fabulous piece on the necessity defense in Pilgrim that I'm very appreciative of. So anyways, having trees is not going to prevent an act of malfeasance.
I can just imagine the potential for ill under these circumstances. I know that as regards Indian Point, somebody I know here who is a filmmaker showed some footage he had from a documentary that's not fully edited yet. And he was on the river facing Indian Point and very close to the intake. And he just went there and he parked the boat and he said, well, we expect to have security out here any minute. And he kept on checking in. It's like every few minutes and then every 5 minutes and then every 10 minutes and then every 20. And it was a couple of hours and nobody had come out yet.
Wow. Yeah. Yeah.
So this is a security risk within our country. But yet I think people don't take nuclear seriously for the weakness and the potential for devastation that it does hold.
Right. Absolutely. And especially with the spent fuel pools, you know, the Union Concerned Scientists completed that study with their Princeton peers that found if there was a spent fuel pool fire at Pilgrim, the contamination could extend from Manhattan to Nova Scotia. I'll send you that map. And we have brought it to every elected official, every testimony that we've presented has involved this map. Actually, Senator Markey requested it from the Union Concerned Scientists to look at what was in the spent fuel pool at Pilgrim and how that would be impacted. And when we were at the Pilgrim site, when the NPR reporters and I were on the site, they didn't call the police until we walked into the building because the police report said they were called at 11 o'clock. That's when we left.
This is all terribly upsetting, but at the same time, not unexpected. When one looks at the risks that are taken to our health, safety, to the security of this country, based on domestic nuclear reactors, spent fuel pool, inappropriate storage of waste, and even the unremediated uranium mines in Navajo Nation and on other Native lands as well, on the Lakota Reservation as well. So we are at risk from all directions. And I think Pilgrim is a particular object lesson if people are willing to pay attention to it. So what is being done now to snap people out of the, oh, well, it's closed, our problems are over frame of mind, and to realize that this is ongoing and it's not going to go away by itself?
Oh, and that is a huge issue because now with this agreement, even people who kind of are in the know are saying, well, now that that's resolved. And I thought, no, it's far from resolved. This is a good start. The state has a little bit more oversight, but Holtec is still going to need to be under heavy scrutiny. And the citizens are still going to have to be picking and checking out all of these reports, going to meetings, doing the research, and connecting with people across the country to make sure that our communities are protected because our government is failing to do that for us.
What has been the hardest part for you in all of this work, especially after, shall we say, four decades of doing it?
The hardest part is the disappointment in our government in listening to our citizens. And we're seeing that now in full bloom everywhere. It should be about our communities and we, our stakeholders, and what we say and what we ask should be holding more weight than a corporation making profits.
And how do you deal with this when perhaps it wells up and feels unbearable?
Well, I feel privileged that I have the time and I have a supportive family and I can do this work. So I feel very privileged.
So it's gratitude that gets you out of any slumps you might find yourself in.
Right. Because you know what? It's about we the people, and it's about govern with our consent. And we do not give our consent to this nonsense.
Anything else you would like to add at this time that we haven't had a chance to go into?
I would recommend people read this agreement, because this is the start of what's happening for decommissioning, and particularly with Holtec. buying up a lot of nuclear power reactors. I think there's some really good stuff in here that other states might be able to model, but there's also warnings about wiggle room and that we have to stay ever vigilant to being on top of this issue.
And if listeners to Nuclear Hot Seat were to come to the support of the work that you and the others are doing, what might that look like? What can we do for you?
Stay on top of everything in your own communities and let's stay connected because we're all in the same boat. We are redoing our website to update it for decommissioning. So I can't send people to the website, but I would just say continue working in your own community, talking to your neighbors, writing your letters, and stay on it because, you know, it's about our future.
And not only our future, but our children and our children's grandchildren.
Yes. We have a responsibility to make sure the next generations are safe. And again, too, we have a campaign, safety is a human right.
Great slogan, because it is.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Diane Turco, it's always illuminating and inspiring to listen to you, as well as absolutely infuriating with the information that you are sharing. That's a given anytime we talk. And I want to thank you for being so consistently on point with the topic and with the needs of your community, as well as thank you for being my guest this week on Nuclear Hot Seat.
Thank you for the great work you're doing in keeping this issue alive all over the world.
Diane Turco is director of the Cape Downwinders. About those visuals she mentioned, the Princeton University map of radioactivity dispersal, should there be a fire at the Pilgrim Spent Fuel Pool, is this week's keystone or episode ID picture. On the website, we will also have a picture of that poison ivy warning sign picture from Pilgrim, and we'll have a link up to the Dave Lockbaum piece on the necessity defense, which is what is going to be used by Diane Turco in her trial.
Activist, shout out.
Our friends at the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons, ICANW.org, has announced a new website they've created that commemorates the 75th anniversary of the bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. The website is part of their campaign to remember and honor the victims of the atomic bombings and to educate and bring new people into the movement to ban and eliminate them. They have compiled a calendar of events of what is being done around the world to commemorate the dropping of these two atom bombs. We will link to it. And highlighting some unique opportunities to hear the Japanese survivors of the atomic bombings, the Hibakusha, tell their stories directly so you can understand the true horror of an atomic bomb. ICANN is also announcing a world-exclusive live tour of the Hiroshima and Nagasaki museums, which will take place at the end of July. You'll be able to see this all directly from your home because it will be online. And when they have the exact date and time posted, I'll pass this along to you on Nuclear Hot Seat. And don't forget another website that has been created specifically to commemorate the 75th anniversary of the dropping of the atom bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. That would be HiroshimaNagasaki75.org. That's from a coalition of groups that have gotten together to provide everything that you will need to be able to publicize and make people aware of something other than a pro-nuclear stance when these anniversaries come up. Trust me, we are going to be inundated by pro-nuclear nonsense and why we need the bomb. The clearly stated stance of this program and this person is that we do not. This will give you a toolkit for creating memes, posts, email messages, what you can do to empower yourself and the rest of us to shut down nuclear bombs forever. We should only live so long. Here's today's final thought. People just don't seem to get it about how dangerous nuclear weapons are. The nuclear industry, military-industrial complex, and those who support them in government are pushing for more nuclear weapons, championing smaller, more usable atomic bombs, as if they were somehow desirable. But nuke mongers hailing the development of smaller bombs is akin to a diabetic claiming that by eating a small ice cream sundae every night, it's not as bad for them as a large ice cream sundae. But that's just ridiculous relativism. Bad is bad. And when it comes to nuclear weaponry, it's important for everyone to understand why they're so dangerous and why they must never be used. So how are we conditioned to accepting nukes at all? One insidious way, which I've only recently been made aware of, is through video games. These are aimed at children, teens, and young adults. And by using cartoonish or overblown images of the mushroom cloud and fireball as part of their game, they subliminally embed the thought that using nuclear bombs is fun, a good advantage to take, a way to win. Certainly there is no mention of the horrors of radiation sickness, nuclear winter, or slow death by cancer or other diseases, or the generational extermination of our species by DNA damage that will result. If you have a strong stomach and you would like to take a look, I'll have a link up on our website to a feature showing the top 10 nuclear images in video games. Note that none of them in any way reveals the aftermath and the consequences. But there is another nuclear game I want to bring to your attention. You might already be familiar with Nuke Map, Alex Wellerstein's brilliant feature that allows you to program a location, you can do so with a zip code, a bomb size, a few other variables, and then detonate it to see what damage will result, as well as providing concentric colored circles, which will reveal details about what kind of effect would hit people and where. It's a great way to see what a Hiroshima-sized atomic bomb, really a wimp of a bomb by today's standards, what a Hiroshima bomb would do to your neighborhood. Then, if you want to go big or go home, you can fool around with Castle Bravo or Tsar Bomba, just for laughs. Now, however, there's a new game out that's like Nuke Map on steroids. It's NuclearWarSimulator.com by Ivan Stepanov. It's a nuclear conflict simulation and visualization tool, and it's free online. Nuclear War Simulator can be used to visualize large-scale nuclear conflicts and estimate the humanitarian impact. The simulation includes a population density grid to render an impact not just in terms of blast radius, but in the deaths and injuries that can easily number in the millions. While initially conceived of as a game, there is no winning in this nuclear war, and no set or measurable objectives. There are instead an array of menus of weapons, delivery vehicles, launch patterns, and sequencing, allowing users to explore just what it would look like when, say, there's a slight exchange of a couple of nuclear warheads, and that escalates into a planet-shattering conflagration of ICBM flights and submarine launches and fallout and casualties. It is a way to make visible the often forgotten specter of nuclear annihilation that hangs over each and every one of us on Earth at all times. Program creator Stepanov was born in the city Semipalatinsk in Kazakhstan, which is known for the fact that the Soviet Union was testing most of their nuclear weapons on a test site just 150 kilometers, 93 miles, away. Stepanov said, "Everybody in my family, including me, has experienced atmospheric or underground nuclear weapons tests. This downwinder experience by himself and his entire family was part of his motivation in creating Nuclear War Simulator." Stepanov went on to say, "The biggest motivation to create this software is the constant threat of a nuclear war. We still have over 13,000 nuclear weapons on this planet. And while deterrence may have reduced the probability of a conflict between major powers, this probability does not equal zero. By building a tool to let people simulate that tragedy, Stepanov hopes to make the unimaginable comprehensible and, in turn, urge people towards action. The site for the simulation includes links to both ICANN, the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons, and IPPNW, International Physicians for the Prevention of Nuclear War. Again, quoting Stepanov, "To describe a nuclear war honestly is to argue for the abolition of nuclear weapons." You can check out the program at nuclearwarsimulator.com or just go to our website, nuclearhotseat.com, under this episode, number 472, and click on the link. This has been Nuclear Hot Seat for Tuesday, July 7, 2020. Material for this week's show has been researched and compiled from nuclear-news.net, deunrenard.wordpress.com, Beyond Nuclear International, the International Campaign for the Abolition of Nuclear Weapons, or ICANN, losalamosreporter.com, cortezmosto.senate.gov, tri-cityherald.com, defenseone.com, Bob Alvarez, ReviewJournal.com, TimesOfSanDiego.com, InDepthNews.net, LATimes.com, Dianuke.org, NuclearCulture.com, Forbes.com, and the ever-co-opted Nuclear Regulatory Commission. Thanks to Laura Lynch for the image of a diabetic eating a smaller ice cream sundae as a parallel to the so-called advisability of using small nuclear bombs. That was a great talking point, and I suggest we all use it. Thanks to all of you for listening, and a big shout out to Nuclear Hot Seat listeners and followers around the world in 123 countries on 6 continents and counting. Lots of people don't want nukes to happen. 2 things you can do to help. You can go to the Nuclear Hot Seat Facebook page, like it, share it, respond to a post. That's how we get out to others. And you can also go to the website, nuclearhotseat.com, scroll down to the yellow opt-in box, and just put in your first name and an email address, and we will send you 1 email a week with a link to the program, a little bit of writing about what's inside of it, and in that way, you need never miss another episode. Now, if you have a story lead, a hot tip, or a suggestion of someone to interview, send an email to info@nuclearhotseat.com. And if you appreciate weekly verifiable news updates about nuclear issues around the world, and especially if you would like to help us keep going during these times, go to the website, look for either the red or the green button, click on it, take some action, help us out. Anything will be of assistance, and we'll really appreciate your support. Nuclear Hot Seat is copyright 2020, Libby Halevi and Hardestry Communications. All rights reserved, but fair use allowed as long as proper attribution is provided. This is Libby Halevi of Hardestry Communications, the heart of the art of communicating, reminding you that nobody wins a nuclear war. Nobody. There you go. That is your nuclear wake-up call. So don't go back to sleep, because we are all in the nuclear hot seat.
Nuclear hot seat. What are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat. What have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat. The corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are linking. Nuclear hot seat. It's the bomb.